And I'm Jude.
And welcome back to Just Friends.
Yay.
Today we have a very special guest, and I'm going to let Jude introduce them.
Today, we have the privilege to be joined by one of the most unique, inspiring, and thoughtful undergrads at Yale, maybe in the world. James Hatch is a rising senior who is majoring in the humanities. However, before joining the undergrad class, he had more than 25 years of experience in the U.S. Navy and 22 years in the SEALs teams. He's a member of the Naval Special Warfare Development Group, a master parachutist, an expert military dog trainer, and was involved in 150 missions across Iraq, Bosnia, Africa, and Afghanistan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Welcome, welcome.
Wow, that was quite an intro. And I bet it does sound a little odd. I'm sure you've probably not had another guest that had that kind of stuff going on,
So many different facets to you.
right? No. Well, look, man, if nothing else, I am certainly an example that there is something to that whole American dream stuff, you know. I was a kid who got bounced around a little bit as a young kid and then joined the service really young and got to see a lot of things, do a lot of things. Some of it really great, some of it not so great. But wow, I mean, growing up in a trailer park in Utah, you know, and now I'm 56 and a rising senior at Yale. Are you kidding
Can I hear a little bit more on just like
Yeah.
that path from being like this kid who's living in a trailer park, and then what drove you to join the military, and then what drove you to kind of at from there to the and also Yale? I'm just kind of curious to hear a little bit of the life story.
Okay. Well, I'll try to. So the military thing was really qu quite simple. It was clear to me from a very young age in my environment that relationships were transaction. So if you did this, you these were your the consequences for that action. If you did this, you got to eat. If you did, you know, so I was drawn to kind of that military, the narrative, I guess. It's a really bad one, and it's something that I've really had to confront here as I fall in love with these classics and stuff. But this narrative about war, it's a place where you can become a man, you know, in my look, I'm a lot older than you guys, so help me out here. Give me a little grace. But you know, it was where I could grow up and be, you know, I'm an insecure young kid, and I thought, okay, if I just work hard, and especially if I can get into one of those like special units, man, I'll be a real man. Then I'll be really worthy of people's love and acceptance, you know. So I guess that was part of it. I think another part of it for me, and a really strong one, that took me a long time to admit, but I really wanted to hurt people that did things to innocent people, and that came from you know, the bottom of my soul. I've just been a part of that stuff as a child, and it was interesting after I've gotten out and, you know, spent some time away from that community, and when I get back together, you know, we're older now and we can talk about things that we couldn't before. And it's really interesting how many of us suffered that kind of stuff, you know, what drove guys to go do that kind of stuff. So, interesting. Anyway, so the military was, I knew that, hey, man, if I busted my ass and I worked hard, I would have a chance. And that's all you know, that's all I really wanted. College wasn't really something that was ever like, it wasn't something that was ever talked about, actually. You know, I guess I, from the time I was probably, about the time I started junior high, I knew I was going to join the military. And so after that, I didn't really think about what else I would do.
I have a question that just also came up from that, which is like, I'm curious, like you said, when you kind of reunite with people that in that community, you are able to kind of have a different shared understanding and probably, I think, more vulnerable shared understanding. Is that, I don't want to put words in your mouth.
No, I think that's true. I think part of that's maturity, right? And I think another thing that is maybe different. Well, no, for sure it is. Like, I've given some talks, speeches around the country, veterans groups, different military, you know, law enforcement, blah, blah, blah. And we are now in a place where a guy like me can stand up and say, hey, look, I was at the one of the hardest units in the world to get to. And I trained and I was really good at my job. And I could go out and create some serious problems for our enemies. And then I was broke. Like that shit couldn't happen, you know, 10 years ago. Well, maybe 10 years ago, maybe. It's about the time I went sideways. So I think a lot's changed. You know, and I give those speeches oftentimes, especially veterans. I gave one recently for the Yale Club of New Haven. And there was a gent in the back who came to me after. I call it the after party when you give a speech. There's always, especially when you talk about, like with me, I talk about mental health stuff and physical, emotional, sexual abuse, that kind of stuff. And of course, that brings up all kinds of ghosts for people. So the after party is where people come up who didn't want to raise their hand and talk about what they had, but they want to talk. You know? And this guy walked, a big dude, man, walked up and he had tears in his eyes, really well dressed, good shape, quite a bit older than me. And, he had tears in his eyes. He goes, how long did it take you to trust civilians? And, you know, I can put it together. You know, he's a Vietnam vet. And I think if I had lived through what that guy lived through, I don't know that I would have been able to forgive civilians either. And I said, well, I said, it took me a little while. I said, but my life's been a lot better since. And, you know, like, honestly, and being at Yale has really been a part of that. Being around you guys, you guys talk a lot of shit and you think you know a lot more than you do, which is fine. You know, I was 20 once, right? But you guys also work your asses off and you give a shit about people and you care that things are fair. And that is good. That makes the world a better place, you know? And I don't know, man. I think leaving the military and being broke and trying to figure out how to get through that showed me that nobody's an island. Nobody gets where they're at on their own. And I wish that I'd have spent a lot more time being grateful, you know?
I think one major thought that came up from that. First, I think it's really helpful and important that you mentioned like the narrative that serving can create for a lot of people. I think like I don't know. I think I find it hard to, I mean, I don't think I can ever empathize with someone who serves necessarily, but I think I find it hard to understand a lot of the like plethora of reasons someone can go into the army. And I think even the comment you just said about like, we're 20, we talk a lot of shit and we think we know everything. I think one of the biggest points where, which is true, let me say, completely true. Yes.
With everybody. Yes.
I think, sorry, that sounds like a criticism. That was like, yes, we do that. That's the podcast. I think, I'm just comparing that to like how young you were going to serve. And like, that's where I get stuck with a lot of people who go into the army or the military and just with the United States. It's like, why, how is it okay to serve and like make that big of a decision before you're allowed to drink legally and all of that? Oh. And yeah, I don't know. I'm just wondering, I guess, more about like the age.
It's really interesting. I think it's really interesting. I think there are families that have traditions, like, you know, there are legacy people at different universities. It's the same thing in the military. And that's huge. That's a very big part of it. I think another thing is, especially now, man, think about it, right? Like, it's funny too, because I really didn't get it until I got out of the military, started my little nonprofit and hired my first employee. She was 24 years old, no pre-existing conditions. And getting her health care was shocking, right? So in the military, you don't have to worry about that. And you don't make great money. You don't make enough money to have eight kids, even though some people still do that while they're in the military, right? But you know, you do fine. It's not a bad life if you're a person who's a crazy person like me and some of the people that I, and I say crazy, I think we were just driven, very driven. you know, there's that opportunity in the military, and there's really not very many of those people, truthfully, that go out and do the kind of stuff that we did. It just, there's just not many. But there's so much other work that the military does, and that's a whole different discussion, that you could join the military and get skills to do, you know, whether it's IT stuff or if you want to learn languages, whatever. There's all kinds of things to do in the military. So I think sometimes people see it as a way to like go to college. I'm going to a conference here at the University of Chicago on Thursday, and it's a veterans thing. I'm going to help represent Yale with some of the people from admissions.
I have a question that arose just because I still have one part of the story that is not fully clear to me, which is how you got to Yale. Like, what was that? What was how, like,
oh,
what brought you to Yale and not another school? What brought you want, what made you want to go to school again? All of that.
When I was really young, I didn't like school at all. I couldn't, I didn't deal with the structure. I didn't realize that I had a lot of what would now be called, you know, disabilities, learning disabilities. I didn't know that, it was, you know, nobody cared really. So, school wasn't really something that I ever really thought about. But when I got in the military and I started to look at the people around me that I had respect for, the people who were kind, but strong, the people who had, you know, and oftentimes these were my leaders, the people who I answered to, who gave me jobs to do and told me how to conduct my life. And there were people who could do that gracefully, and with humility and kindness. And then there were people who were assholes. And so I started trying to figure out what it was that made the difference with those people. And I started noticing that a lot of the people that were judicious and thoughtful, they almost always had a book with them. They were always around a book. So I started looking at what they were reading, and I started trying to read it. And I couldn't, I couldn't do it very well because, you know, I dropped out of high school and took a GED to get my diploma so that I could go in the military. I wasn't a stellar student. I've always liked to read, but like trying to read the Iliad when you're, you know, with no real background in any of it, you know, it was tough. But I still kept trying. I kept swinging, and I kept trying to find things that would make it easy for me to pick things up that were kind of timeless, like the classics stuff. I read a Tom Wolfe book one time. You find yourself in these crazy places in the military where you're just kind of stuck for like a week for no good reason. Like you're flying from someplace to someplace else. The plane breaks and they're like, oh, all right, you guys are going to be here for a while. There's a building over there. Go grab a bed. And the chow hall opens at whatever time. And there's some books in there, you know, anyway. So I read a Tom Wolfe book, and in it, one of the characters talks about Epictetus. So I start reading about Epictetus, the Stoics. That's how I learned, right? So then I start asking some of the people that I work with, you know, who's like Stoics? They're like, oh yeah, Marcus Aurelius. And I'm like, okay. And I start reading, you know, they're like, holy shit, you know. So I knew, I kept getting pushed. I kept steering back to the classics, and I knew that there was something about it. And I think I figured it out this year, finally, what it was that I wanted to say that it was. But I think it's the connective tissue. I think literature is the connective tissue. You know, back when Homer told that story, it was through singing, right? So it was an oral tradition. And then it was written down and rewritten and blah, blah, blah. But like the things in those books and the ones before them, truly, you know, it points to me that the people who lived then were the same people that live now. We just have iPhones and running water. We're still savages. We still have the same issues. We still, you know, politics. We still, like, we're the same. And I feel like that's, I don't know, man, there's something to that. But, you know, look, I come from a place where I spent most of my adult life, you know, doing damage. And this is, Yale is a place where I do the opposite, I feel like. I spent a lot of time in the art gallery. A lot. Just because that's the opposite of what I did for the majority of my life.
Do you have a word for the opposite of damage that you're doing at Yale?
Building. I think mostly myself, which is interesting. I definitely can be a better human. In fact, when I first got here, Professor Quint and I were walking. I was in DS and he was my literature professor. And what a gift, man. Holy cow. I was walking up and he said, "So why are you here, James?" I said, "I guess I just want to be a better human." So yeah. So I'm building that, I think, a little bit. That's been hard, man. It's been a lot harder than I thought it would be. Yeah. And I want to take things I learned from you guys. And some of the things that I've learned in my classes, and you know, spread the wealth a little bit in the ways that I can, just because then I come from a whole different universe, and having dipped my toe in the, you know, kind of the high end of academia, there's a lot to be shared with, you know, people from my old world and you know, other places as well. So, but how did I get to Yale? This is actually really funny. So a friend of mine was at a conference in Las Vegas. And it was some type of a leadership conference. And there's a professor from Yale who was there at the conference and they kind of met, you got to be friends. They're both kind of fitness guys and whatever. So this professor says, "Hey man, I want to go skydiving." And my friend says, "I know just the guy to go with. That's me. That was my deal. I was a big skydiver, right?" So, my buddy calls me. He's like, "Hey man, I got this friend. He's a Yale professor. He wants to go skydiving." I'm like, "All right, cool. You know, I'll go." And I take pictures. I have a helmet with cameras on it. And I take pictures. I was excited, you know, but I pictured some like 70-year-old dude, you know, with this little pocket thing with his pens in it and shit, you know. No, this professor's name is Zach Cooper. He teaches economics. He's kind of a research machine, but he's like 40 years old. He looks like Bradley Cooper. You know what I mean? He's handsome. He's in great shape. He's a great athlete. You know, I was like, holy cow. He went to, you know, he was a downhill ski racer. I mean, he did a great job. And when we got done with the jump, I was pretty impressed with him, you know, because he held his mud. You know, you can be as tough as you want, but when you go out of that airplane the first time, I can see your soul, man. You can't like pose your way out of that shit. That's for real. He was awesome. He did great. Anyway. So he actually reached out to me about a week after that and said, "Hey man, what do you think about coming up to Yale?" Let me backtrack quick. After I got out of the service and went through all the psychiatric stuff, and I did try to go to school here locally at a local college, and I went to some classes and I really didn't like it because it just seemed like nobody was really interested in learning. It was almost like just ticket punching. And I didn't get that. And I thought it was just a waste, you know? So I'd done some online stuff too, which isn't really, I don't even think that you should call that academia, but anyway. So I said to my friend, Zach, my new friend, I'm like, "Yeah, I'd love to come see Yale." So I go up and he had arranged for me to give a talk at Timothy Dwight. And, some of the law enforcement people around there know me. So some of those guys came, like the head of the ETF and some of the FBI guys. And then there were some of the students, which was really cool because I'm in TD now, which is funny. And then we went to dinner with Jim Levinson, who is the dean of the Jackson School of Global Affairs, right? So we were at dinner and I have a bunch of tattoos, but this one right here, the red band. Yeah. And he asked me, he said, "Hey, what does that say?" And I said, "Well, in 1971, Pablo Neruda was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. And in his banquet speech, he said, 'Through blood and darkness, poetry is written. Poetry should be written.'" And that hit me, you know, it made a big impression on my soul. I said that to him. He goes, "You need to apply for this Eli Whitney program we have." And I said, "What's that?" You know, so that he explained it. And I'm like, "Look, man, I really appreciate that. But I was not a good student. I mean, I didn't do well. I never took an SAT. I never took," he goes, "It's not about that." I said, "Well, what's it about?" He said, "It's about the life that you live, you know, before you get here." So I'm like, "Okay." whatever. So they send me the link to the application. Zach does. Now, mind you, I don't know that Zach is this incredibly busy, on the edge of tenure professor who's working his ass off to get all these papers published. He's going out of his way to really, put his arm around me, show me Yale, tell me everything he knows about it. And I'm just blown away by it. Anyway, so I go home, back down here to Virginia, and every few days I'd get a text from Zach Cooper, like, "Hey man, did you do the application?" I'm like, "No man, I appreciate it. I just not, I don't have any business doing that." And then one day I was like, "Hey, you know what? What the hell? What's the worst thing that can happen?" So I did the application, and now listen, I'd never done a college application, and I didn't understand what things are important in the college application. Right? So it took me, honestly, the whole application took me about 45 minutes, and like both essays, everything, right? So I finish it up, I'm like, click, send. And I text my buddy Zach. I'm like, "Hey man, I just want you to know I did the application." He goes, "What?" He goes, "How long did it take you?" I said, "It's about 45 minutes." He goes, wait. He said, "Did you do the essays?" I said, "Yeah, it didn't seem all that hard, man. There were just a couple of easy prompts, you know?" He goes, "Wait, Jimmy, do you understand?" I'm like, "No." He goes, "Look, man, people spend thousands of dollars to get help on those essays to get into a school like Yale." I'm like, "Well, it didn't seem all that hard to me." Anyway, so he's like, "Hey man, do me a favor, email admissions and ask them if you can resubmit those essays. And just, you rewrite them and then let me look them over." By the way, I didn't know this, but he also was he went to the, for his PhD, he was at the London School of Economics, and he was a speech writer for Tony Blair. So he knew some things
Whoa,
about,
he knows.
So I sent them an email. Admissions are like, "Nah, but you could submit two more if you'd like." I'm like, "Okay." So I did that. And then it was a few months, and then I got the email that I was accepted, and my wife was like, "Are you fucking kidding me?" She's like, "You're an idiot if you don't go up there and do that." I'm like, "All right, so here we are."
Wow.
Did you find that the two new essay versions were very different from your original ones?
Actually, I was somewhat shocked that they were really similar, but they had this thing called punctuation, which is helpful.
Right.
The thing is, I think I have, I've definitely got a rich background to draw from. So that gets me over some of the other things that maybe would hold me back if I didn't have that background, I think.
I was thinking this like before you went more into how you actually ended up at Yale, but just talking about building yourself and doing the opposite of harm. I don't know. Just you saying that was a very huge reality check-in personally, and really,
Oh.
I don't know, like immediately. Like 5 minutes into talking, you said how you wish you kind of had been more grateful. And I think that's something Jude and I have been talking a lot about. And I mean, I know you've said that like you get some good energy and knowledge and things off of the 20-year-old Yalies, but I'm just wondering if there are any like more negative or disappointing experiences, I guess. My context for this is Jude and I kind of like have made a point of catching ourselves complaining a lot about Yale and just
A
being in an
lot.
environment where there's like a huge, just like energy of ungratefulness to be at the school. I think, especially like during finals and stuff, just like no one is happy to be there. And it gets really hard. It's really hard to kind of remind yourself of everything. All the privilege that's takes being there. I don't know.
I think one of the things that is easier as I've gotten older is that I definitely think I understand what other people think as much. Like, I don't think I really understand people hardly at all ever. And that's been really helpful. But what I do see, what you're talking about was, I think what I've seen is, like, it's almost like a, hey, we all have this one thing in common. It's Yale, and we'll talk shit and it's fun. And it's something that we can kind of talk around, and but it's almost always negative, and it's almost always like talking shit about other Yalies who are this or who are that, you know. And as an older guy, of course, I'm like just, you know, it's almost like I'm not there, which is fine. I mean, it's cool. Actually, I get away with picking my nose and stuff, but like, I think, you know, I see it, and it, at first glance, it's like, well, those kids, they don't understand how good they got it. They fucking do. They're just having a time where they're just bitching and blowing off steam. And I think most, in fact, you know, when I talk to my friends from my previous life about it, you know, like, what are you, you know, these kids, I'm like, they're great. They're kids though, right? You know, you can be in a class. It's so great to be in a class with you guys. Like, in a class, I'm sitting there and it's a seminar and we're talking and everybody's talking like the professor. And we get out in the hall and inevitably one or two of the students will be chatting, and then like Thursday, like I'm gonna like go like it's so funny, like you can make this switch
Yeah.
between being this badass academic to just being a, basically a teenager, you know, which is fine. Yeah, it's funny. And I think like it's okay. That's another thing that's hard about Yale is you guys are all, and I get this, and it's the same way it was at my units in the military, because of the vetting process. Because you had to push yourself to get to where you are. And that's just the bottom line. And because of that, you are driven. And because of that standard, everybody else is driven. And when you get a bunch of driven people together, it can be a blessing on one hand, and it can also be, you know, challenging. And I think that's where leadership comes in, blah, 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 which the military can teach the university a thing or two. It's interesting.
Will you
That's something you're subject.
like, can I double click on that though a little bit? Like, can
Yeah.
you expand on that?
Yeah, I think, you know, what happens is what I've seen so far, my anecdotal experience is by and large, university professors come from the university. They're academics. They're brilliant. They have a great work ethic. They understand culture. They understand the nuances of different cultures. They understand the challenges of different parts of the university to accomplish a mission, blah, 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 blah. But what they've never done is go through any type of a leadership training course at all. None. And the military does that. The military takes that very, very seriously. Even when you're pretty new in the military and you start actually being put in a position where you have people that will answer to you, like you go through courses to it. You actually, you know, you really train for it. And if you don't have it, you don't get the promotion, right? Like you have to demonstrate that you have some of the, you know, tenets of good leadership, whatever the military's decided they are this week, right?
What type of leadership would you want to see then? Like, just can you like what is lacking from Yale in a leadership like point of view?
I think sometimes it seems as though decisions don't really happen. Really hard issues don't get discussed, really. Like really scary, bad things that can happen. They're just kind of not talked about. And I know that's changing, and I've brought that up, but you know, I think maybe there's some opportunity that there could be some cross-pollination between elite military units and like a university like Yale. Because I think, and there's some of that with Jackson School for sure. But I think that both organizations could really learn a lot from each other, for real. And I mean, in a good way, that they could benefit a lot of people and our country, which is no small thing. One of the things that's a negative to me is, it's interesting to me, and this isn't a Yale thing. This is an academia thing. I see it actually less at Yale, but when I see it at Yale, it's like on fire. I think it's interesting if you live in a bubble, of your, where you do this one thing and everybody comes into the class and relies on you and they have to pay attention to you and they have to kind of go, like, I'm not trying to say that you can't have a different opinion than the professor, but the professor does have a lot of, control over, especially you guys, young people that are trying to get into other schools. Like, that grade makes a big difference, right? So, I think sometimes a human being, smart as they are and good as they are, can let that kind of go to their head. And I see it sometimes. And it's actually, part of it is because I'm older now and it's a lot easier to see those kinds of things. And it's actually kind of funny because by and large, it's harmless, you know? It's just this thing that people we have going, I believe, I'm sure I've got them too. You know, these things that you have going on in your head that you've kind of created this narrative about yourself. But most of the time, I don't care if you're arrogant. I mean, if you're really good at what you do, I really don't care. So, you know, as long as we're getting stuff done, it's when that arrogance creates an us versus them kind of thing. That's a problem.
Just like to push back on that, or at least like, yeah, mm-hmm. and have you respond is like, I struggle when it's arrogance, when there's no listening. Right? Because I do think that there are times where people can provide a different insight and perspective. And as you just said, with like one of the benefits of having a military kind of leadership could be kind of looking at different perspectives, right? And like not, and like having the hard conversations that people are not always willing to have. And if you're so arrogant that you're not willing to have those conversations because you're so set that this is the right way, I do think that that is like a, I think arrogance can be fine until it leads to like one perspective and no listening.
Yeah. I think at the point at which another human decides to stop listening, there's really no reason to continue, because at this point it's become, I'm going to defend it. And it's now I just can't, like, we can't really have a discussion. We're just going to go back and forth. I think one of the things in academia that's challenging is the way that everything is so, I mean, it seems so dramatic. Like, we're going to have times where we disagree, and that's just the way of it. And sometimes people are going to get upset and they're going to scream and holler, and that's okay, man. Like, shit happens, right? Like, it's just like, ooh, come on. Everybody just like chill a little bit, you know? And I think that has to come from the leadership. Like, when people talk to me about how do you create an environment, you know, with, you know, a strong environment for mental health. And I said, it has to come from leadership. It has to come from people exhibiting those behaviors and meaning, hey, how are you? No, really, how are you? Like, I don't even say that to people anymore. I don't say, hey, how you doing? I say, how's your heart? Right? Like, I don't, you know, like that's the kind of stuff that I think there needs to be more of. You know, the negatives about Yale are also choices. I can keep going and find a bunch, you know, but I'm look, man, maybe it's the whole trailer park thing. I don't know. But like, are you kidding me? It's so amazing. And if I need help, fuck, man, there's people that'll help me. And I don't really have to ask more than a couple of people, you know, it's really amazing. And also, you know, there's this extra thing to it that I don't know that you guys see. But, you know, you're walking around and you're probably two of the people that are going to do this. But there's some people that are walking around with us that are going to change the world. And I'm not like I'm going to change the world. I mean, everybody's going to change the world. But I'm talking like people are going to do great things. I mean, you guys are probably two of them. And so when I get to be in a situation with young people like you guys, it's I feel a sense of duty. Which is a good thing for me. I like that kind of feeling of obligation, you know? So I feel like I need to do what I can to give these young people the best view of my experiences that can help them when they get in positions where they're making decisions about stuff. So that's actually the way I look at it. And I actually kind of see it almost like a mission. But
I have like a lot of things that came up. I've just been kind of ruminating.
That's good.
I don't know. I haven't experienced other like upper academia atmospheres, environments, but I think it's a very like elite institution phenomenon of kind of like, we really need to look closely and examine all of these problems, and they're kind of intangible because you guys are lucky enough to be here. And then there's this whole, like, I don't know. I think part of why Jude and I created the podcast is because we both felt like we were stuck with the, like, well, what do we do? Like, no, we're just being faced with all these problems. I'm a sociology major. I've taken two classes with the chair, who I love and is incredibly wise. And he always is like, you know, sociologists just come up with more questions. And no one kind of, like, I don't want to say attacks, but faces these problems that everyone is, like,
right,
spending their entire undergraduate degree thinking
yeah.
about. And I think here I'm trying to connect it to the mental health thing that you brought up.
Oh, it's connected for sure.
Yeah, it's very, that's, I think, Jude and I's other big topic is, like, mental health at Yale. And why does every conversation about it feel so surface? And even you saying, how's your heart? Jude and I started doing that. Because
oh,
we're
wow.
Like, yeah, because Jude was like, you know what? I'm going to start asking this to people. Because we're like saying, yeah, how's your day? Everyone's just like, fine, and keeps walking. And it's really, it's more disheartening than, like, I don't know, not asking. I don't know if I have a question. Those are my thoughts. I guess I'm wondering more about your approach to talking about mental health, because I feel like Yale really, it's one of the things that's very, very tiptoed around in action, even though it's increasingly discussed.
Yeah. So let me try to answer that in a way that is instructive. There are issues at Yale, specifically issues about Yale. Things that happen at Yale or don't happen at Yale, or that people don't want to talk about. Here's what's frustrating to me about Yale or academia, if there are other institutions like Yale. In the military, there are conventional units, and there are really smaller special operations units, and then there are even really smaller ones. And the way that you get to those really smaller ones is you're a person who isn't the kind of soul that says, hey, there's a problem. Who's going to fix it? It's, hey, I'm the problem. I see the problem. If I don't fix it, I'm the problem. Let's get what do I got to do to get this done? And everybody is that way all the time. And the problem is that people, I think this is just me looking at things as a veteran coming into this kind of new universe. But I think by and large, most humans, or at least that I've seen civilians, are trained to not lean in, to not lead. I remember seeing a panic button, like if there's a emergency, you know, panic button, and there's like a call box, and you know, and I'm thinking, well, would I do that, or would I get down to business with whatever it is I'm pushing that button for? You know, like, you see where I'm going with that, right? Like,
yeah, totally.
In the military, like the mental health stuff. And I remember once, like, this is a perfect example for it. And I'm sorry, I'm kind of wandering here, but I was asked to be a part of a CNN town hall meeting on suicide after Anthony Bourdain and Kate Spade had committed suicide. It was that, like, there's a week there where like two or three major celebrities had killed themselves. And it was an amazing event for a lot of reasons. Anderson put it on, and Anderson Cooper, his brother, had committed suicide. And, you know, it's a bigger deal. And there were different groups represented there. I was the veteran. There were people from the LGBTQ community. And I did not realize, you know, CNN, of course, had all the data, but the percentages of suicides, I thought it would be veterans would have the highest. It's the LGBTQ kids, the young people. They're the ones that are smoking themselves like in a crazy, it's insane. And I didn't know that until that night. I didn't know it. But anyway, let me get to my point. Another point. At the end of the meeting, they turned the cameras off and took the mics on. They're like, hey man, let's just sit around and bullshit. And it was really cool. There were some really neat people. There were some celebrities there. There were some big political folks there, all of whom had been touched by suicide one way or another. And people kept saying, you know, we need more resources. We need this, we need that. And I'm just fucking tired of hearing it. What we need is for, if somebody's like struggling and I see them struggling, am I uncomfortable talking to them? Will I be more uncomfortable if they smoke themselves later? Because I didn't. And here's a good example. I talk about this a lot with different people that I meet in different organizations at the university. And I worry about it, because it's a struggle, right? Two young people who are associated with a sports team came to me and said, "Hey man, can we chat?" One of their suite mates had attempted suicide and was in a facility. And they were upset. They didn't see it coming. They felt guilty, you know, all those things, right? And which is, you know, that's really common. And then they were really even more, it really upset them more. And I thought this was so cool because it taught them. Because when their friend, a young man, called to talk to somebody, it was a young woman that was on their floor, but not in their suite. And they were surprised that he would call her. And I said, "Well, why do you think that is, fellas? Why do you think he would do that? And what would make him call her? Why would she be preferable?" And I'm like, "I don't know. I don't know." I'm like, "Well, maybe he doesn't feel like she will judge him, right? Like you guys, sports, tough guy, chest beater bullshit, right? Like, and that's, it's not just sports guys. I mean, it can be math guys, right? Like it can be, you know, volleyball ladies. It can be whatever, right? Like those kind of conversations need to happen like ahead of that. Like you can see when your friends, the people that you live around, you can see when they're going through stuff. And it's really interesting. I teach you that in SEAL training, man. Like you're not going to do anything by yourself. So you have to keep an eye on each other all the time, whether it's in the water or jumping out of airplanes, checking each other's gear. Like you're always checking each other. That's something I think we could do a lot more of at Yale. And I don't think that takes, you know, a whole lot. I mean, I think it's just a matter of people putting together and fuck me, man. There's some smart people here that can fucking do that stuff. It's not like it's impossible to do. Sorry, I'm cussing so much. All that time in the Navy, I'll
So
blame
fine.
it. But I really, honestly, I think that's a challenge. And I think, look, the whole time I've heard this in the various forms of communication at Yale, it's always this finger pointing about so and so's not doing enough, so and so's not. No, what are you doing? What am I doing? What are we doing to help each other out? Like, I promise you, man, I wish I could take you guys on like two missions with me where you're hanging it out. You're going into a place where you know the people that you're going to go see want to kill you. And there's bombs all over the place. And you got to take a helicopter in the middle of the night and you're landing somewhere you've never been in your life. And you got to work together and rely on each other. You know, I think that's the other part about the leadership, you guys, right? So in the military, when you make a bad choice, people die, right? In academia, when you make a bad choice, is it that serious? Probably not most of the time. But shouldn't you really go into those decisions with that same level of commitment? Right? Like, shouldn't you look at the decisions you're making? And I think honestly, like I've met some of the senior leaders at Yale and they're very smart, impressive people who want to do the right thing. I just don't think that the system is set up well at all. There's all these different silos and they don't really talk to each other effectively. And it's brilliant, smart people, but they could definitely have a couple of generals come in. Guys from the special operations community and help them. I know that sounds silly at Yale. Boy, that'd go over really well.
I was just gonna say one piece, which is like, I think it's hard because in a place like the military, you have a common one objective. You're a team, and you all need to keep each other safe and protected. And I think that when you put yourself in a context of Yale, even though I wish it was like that, it is, I want to get the A. This is a curved class. I need to get the 40%. It is more competitive and it is more all like, this is for myself. And oh, how are you doing? Like the whole networking and the networking for meals piece, like there is a flavor of you're alone or you're with your people and that's it. Like you only have a small group. And I guess like my question for you that rose is like, how can we create a more like check in with more people and just like, how does an individual counteract that culture?
By creating it themselves, by having their bubble the people that they're, and look, you know, we can't always be like that. Like, believe me, I want to be, you know, Mr. Happy Face every day, but some days I'm an asshole. You know what I mean? So I'm not going to be like, hey, well, how are you today? You know, but by and large, when things are going relatively well and I'm fed and have slept, you know, like I want to be somebody that people feel like, hey, I'm having a struggle, man. I don't want to go talk to that guy. You know, he might be able to help me. So I think about it like that, right? Like, gosh, oh, there's a Rumi poem I read the other day. Said something like, when you get out of bed in the morning, and I'm going to paraphrase in my redneck Utah way, of course, but something like, you know, get your boots on and get to work. There's a lot of people who need your help. You know? And actually, Dean Gendler said something, and I asked her permission to put it on a sweatshirt for my little nonprofit. She said, look, man, if we humans concentrated on our own strengths and everyone else's hurts, the world would be such a better place. Right? Right? Isn't that something, man? You know?
I've been jumping out of my chair, but I have to comment on that first. Jude and I did an episode that was just the two of us a few weeks ago on the meaning of life, or not on the meaning of life. We were criticizing propaganda about the meaningful life, quote unquote. And after like an hour and a half of ranting about nothing, Jude had this takeaway that was incredibly similar to, I think, what you just said. That was something along the lines of, it's not going to make us as individuals feel like we are living our life better by criticizing how other people live theirs. And it feels very similar to focusing on our strengths and their hurts.
Yeah.
The other thing why I jumped out of my chair was when you suggested generals coming to talk at Yale and it not going well. Because that's kind of, I was a
Yeah.
little anxious coming into this recording episode
Oh,
just because I'm like super
yeah.
ill-informed about the military, just generally. And also, I
Yeah.
think hand in hand with that and like my upbringing and Yale and my whatever education, pretty against a lot of what goes on. And
So am I.
this is the, yeah. And I think this is the first time, well, this is the first time that I'm talked to a veteran to this extent. So thank you a ton for kind of opening my brain up. But also, I think that is like everything you've said about what Yale could learn from the military. I've been like, oh, yeah, 100%. I've thought about that and didn't really even think about the military, like the all of the leadership ideas. And I think, I don't know, I'm guessing, I wonder how you feel surrounded by people who are probably majorly opposed to the military. I don't want to like go on a huge rant about the industrial complex and everything, but I think it's important in terms of like your kind of new identity or added identity as a Yalie amongst this like field of very critical thinkers.
Look, I think it is America. I think that's what our country is. And I think people should be able to think and say whatever the fuck you want, you know, like that's what we do here. And it should be okay. And if you're hurting somebody, or if you're making, you know, if you're trying to harm someone, then, you know, obviously that's something that needs to be addressed. But by and large, you should be able to say and think pretty much whatever you want. And I feel like it should be okay. Like we should be not getting upset that, but here's a great example. This is perfect. So, a friend of mine works as a law enforcement professional, and he was called with two other law enforcement people to a Yale health building. And there was a woman who had been asked to leave several times and would not because she wanted medication that they were not going to give her. So the security called the police and the police came to the room. And it was, of course, the cops were all, you know, they all looked like me, all white guys, right? And the woman who was being asked to leave and who would not leave was a black woman. And so the officers were like, ma'am, can we really, can we, you just walk out with us and make this a lot easier on everybody? Because you're going to go out either way. And we don't want to take you to jail. We don't want to have to cuff you or any of this. And so she said, yeah, I'll just walk out. So they started walking out, and they got to another floor, and one of the doctors walked up and started screaming at the cops. You get away from her, you racist motherfucker. You know, like calling all these names and stuff, right? And calling them names. And they were like, wait a minute, what do you, you know? And then the head of security for the health came over, and he's an older black guy. And he said, hey, to the doctor, we called them here. They're not racists. You shouldn't be able to go calling people names. You don't know what's going on. You should really try and put yourself in check and not get too upset, because you don't know anything about the situation. And I told that story actually to Jean Gemmer. And she's like, that's life. That's just what life is about. Like, shit happens and it's okay. You don't have to be, oh my God, what am I going to do? Like, yeah, look, when a cop kneels on a dude's neck for 9 minutes and he dies and we all watch him get murdered. Yeah, of course we need to get on our horse and we need to get to work. Right. But like, if people like Donald Trump and don't like, you know, AOC, I don't give a fuck. Like, who cares? Right. And the issues at Yale are pretty big. You know, some of the things that are talked about often at Yale are things that are important to your age group, particularly climate, you know, that kind of stuff. And that, there should be passion there. There should be that. That's part of what growing up, and it's part of what being an American is being able to talk about stuff. But I think with regard to the military, here's the thing, Ben. I am not a big fan of the military. I think by and large, it's a fucking waste of a lot of resources. And I mean, I'm not talking about expensive toilet seats. I'm talking about billion-dollar airplanes that will never be used because they suck, and getting us involved in wars that are you know, I could go on and on and on. And my wife, who, oh, bless her heart, man, she just passed out on the couch. She's got all the dogs and the kittens with her. She works in finance for the military. And so she sees the actual dollars come and go and what's going on with it. And it's a problem. And you know, that's something that I think I've learned at Yale, but I don't hate the military. The military is mandatory. There are people, and I think this is something, you know, you guys mentioned that Lulu, you mentioned that, I don't know, Jude, do you know a lot of veterans? Do you have veterans in your family?
I know a few, but not many.
Yeah, I think what's really hard, and I'm glad that, you know, actually there's a dichotomy here. I talk shit when I hear my buddies talking shit about kids your age. I'm like, they're like, oh, those kids are weak, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, yeah. Well, guess what? Did you grow up with active shooter drills in school? No, shut up. Did you grow up with a war going on in Afghanistan? No, shut up. Did you go through a pandemic as a child? Shut up, you know, right? So on one hand, you guys are tough in some ways. But also, you're the most protected group of people in the history of the earth. And so you don't, thank God, you don't get to see, let me say it like this. You know who's easy to kill? The guy who just sprayed an 8-year-old little girl in the face with acid, and blinded her and ruined her face, deformed her for going to school. That's an easy person to kill. You know what I'm saying? And I know that's a horrible thing to think about, and I try to avoid it as much as I can, but it's still a reality of where we live. And there are people that will do, given the opportunity, would do horrible things to us, and they wouldn't ask any questions. And I've seen it from Bosnia, which was most horrific. You know, I saw mass graves there, which, by the way, were Muslims putting those mass graves by Christians. And then a few years later, I'm in a war where there's a lot of Christians who hate Muslims for whatever reason and talk about them being murderers. And we just go around the circle doing it, right? we need the military, but it needs to be smart. And we could definitely spend our money better. Like, nobody in the United States should go to school hungry.
I feel pretty passionate about many of the things you just said. And I just have just a few numbers, just because I think they're just pretty crazy you think about it.
Yeah.
The U.S. defense budget for 2023 is $816 billion approximately, which is like more than the next 10 countries combined with the highest. And if you compare that to the education budget, that's $88 billion, and healthcare is $127 billion for the 2023 year.
Yeah.
And so the fact that we're spending like 10x on military and killing and fear and death and protection. But I think you look at all of it over education is just appalling to me. And I guess my question for you is like, you have just painted quite vivid, disgusting, and appalling images. And yet, when we talk to you, you have so much hope. You have so much life and vitality in you. And I just don't, my brain kind of gets stuck there. Like, how have you gone into this world and seen true, true atrocities, way more than Lula and I hopefully will ever see in our life, and still have so much appreciation and gratitude and thoughtfulness and hope?
I don't know, man. I think it's from you guys, really. You guys rub off. You're gonna conquer the world. There's part of that, and I think being, honestly, let me extrapolate on that. I think, it's moving sometimes when, I have a few classmates that I'm very, very close to, and it's moving to have witnessed their trajectory since we started and where they're at. You guys are getting after life.
I have one thing that I just have to voice before we wrap up, which is I've been holding my heart for like the last 15 to 20 minutes, I think. And I haven't fully understood why. Ooh, now my heart's racing fast. And I think I just want to say that having a white male who is a veteran, who is quote unquote the stereotypical strong man that a military would make you, come on a platform with two 20-year-olds who just are talking out of their asses and be so vulnerable and kind and hopeful. That is what I've been looking for a lot. Like, I think that that's part of the reason I tried to do this podcast is that I can like try and give some people like it's okay to be a vulnerable and like thoughtful man. And I think that I finding people that are older than me and more quote unquote manly than me doing that is just truly, truly inspiring. So thank you
Well,
so
thank
from the
you.
bottom of my heart.
Oh man,
Thank you.
that makes my heart happy. Well, let's get together and have some food sometime.
Please, please.
From a not white, not man, I second the message, and I hope people listening are inspired to act with grace. We love to give our guests the opportunity to promote anything if you'd like. I know you have a nonprofit. We have a book. Is there anything you want to?
Yeah, so my nonprofit is called Spike's Canine Fund. My first working dog was killed in Iraq in 2006, and his name was Spike, and he saved my life and the lives of a lot of my buddies. And as I did more and more deployments, I worked with other dogs. Anyway, when I came home, I started it because the dogs that work for different cities and counties and states, their care varies depending on the income of the community they live in. So oftentimes dogs don't get the proper care. They don't have the best equipment. And so we've helped out almost about 2,500 dogs in all 50 states. And we've built obstacle courses for them. We put bulletproof vests on them. We help them out with medical stuff. We teach schools with the best trainers. We actually built the New Haven Canine Officers an obstacle course with, I think, four or five of my classmates, our classmates, came out. That was actually during the pandemic. And we put bulletproof vests on their dogs. Actually, a woman who's a lecturer at the law school sponsored five of them, which is expensive. Yeah, it's really cool.
Well, everyone, and especially you, James,
Ah,
thank you.
thanks, you
And
guys.
I hope everyone has a good Sunday.
All right, you guys, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening, you guys. We'll see you next week.
Love you.
Bye.
Bye.